The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Very good. So, welcome to all of you, and especially those who have come for the introductory retreat. This morning, I thought that I would talk about something which you might find a little vexing. Hopefully not. I thought I would talk a little bit about the activity of faith. And I think that's particularly appropriate this morning for the festival of Bodhidharma, since Bodhidharma is a bit of an exemplar of what we mean by the activity of faith in our tradition. One of the things I find it helpful to reflect on as I go along my own training is that Buddhism is radically different than anything you will encounter in the history of the West. Radically different. We use certain words and terms and forms to give expression to our practice. You might have noticed some overtones of Catholic liturgy today as you go along. Terms like faith and that sort of thing are phrases that you would encounter in Western religious tradition. But we actually mean something quite different by them, or at least we're pointing at something quite different, potentially. I don't want to give the impression that we're alien or completely different. You see some overlaps. That's not my point. But it's useful to recognize that we're doing something quite different. We start off we come to practice for a whole variety of reasons. And it's really useful to keep in mind what your particular reason for coming to practice, for exploring the path of Buddhism. Really important to recognize what that is for you. But in general, we come to practice because we have a sense that there is something more, something, a way of being that's different than the way we are now, something that we can find that will help us, something that we don't yet experience, but that we want to experience. And that sense, that little thing that arises in our mind that says, oh, there is a possibility that life can be different than I know it. That little thing is really, really important, quite valuable. That is what we call bodhicitta, the arising of the mind that seeks the way. It is something that is a part of Buddha nature, a part of our deepest self, a part of something that is indestructible within us. We may or may not be always aware of it. It may or may not appear very strongly for us, but it's there and actually can't be taken away. We might lose track of it for years and years, but it is there. It arises in our hearts, and we can trust it. But it has this element of faith about it, because we don't yet know what that thing is that we're looking for. Or at least we don't think we know it. So we set out, we're looking for something. We have this idea, we're looking for something. Bodhidharma was a man, a human being, who lived around 400, 500 of the Common Era in India. He set out, just like us, there must be something more for me to find. He met his teacher, Prajnatara, a woman, who had found that thing, who understood that thing, understood how other people could find that thing. And when Bodhidharma met her, he said, oh, I think maybe she knows what I'm looking for and can help me. Followed her advice, practiced with her, and found that thing for himself. Each morning, we recite our ancestral line, as you have gotten a little taste of while you were here. That ancestral line is kind of dry and boring, just a list of names. We just repeat it. But what it represents is all of the human beings who have gone through that process from the time of the Buddha down to us. Every one of those people, well, they're kind of great teachers, you know, Bodhidharma, he's really famous, great teacher. Each one of those names represents a whole community, a whole generation, a whole vast number of people who took on the practice of the Buddha Dharma, put it into practice, and realized the fruit of that practice. Each one of those names represents a whole vast number of people, just like us. So the ancestral line I find to be really useful to reflect on. Just a little shorthand version of all those people who have come to practice and been helped by it. So Bodhidharma put the teaching into practice, realized the fruit of it. Then his teacher said, why don't you go to China and teach people there? And he said, okay, I'll do that. But you can imagine in 500 of the Common Era, traveling a couple thousand miles to a completely different world. This is an act of faith. This is an act of taking an action and not knowing what the outcome will be. There's a difference, I think we can make a distinction, maybe a provisional distinction, but maybe a useful one, between the term faith and the term belief. Often they're sort of used interchangeably, but I think, again, for the purpose of my talk, we can make a distinction. Usually, belief has to do with belief in a thing, belief in an idea, belief in a principle, but belief in an object, belief in something. So we have a conception of the thing, and we believe in it, and we act according to that belief. Faith, from the way I see it at this point, is slightly different, because faith in this way has no particular object. It is the act of stepping off into the unknown, the act of going forward in not knowing. It's not blind. It's not just doing something random, because there is that sense that arises in us that a thing is good to do. And that sense of a thing being good to do is not really scientifically provable. It's just a sense. Oh, this seems like a good thing to do, so I'm going to try it. Now, interestingly, that activity of acting on faith changes us. It has an effect. And we can see that effect. It changes us, and we can feel the change. And that change is what we are hoping for, in some sense. There's a nice phrase, After I gave that nice introduction of how we're really different than Christianity, I'm now going to quote the Bible. It's a nice phrase. You know, I think it's the Gospel of St. Mark. He says, "Faith is the evidence of things not seen, the substance of things hoped for." And this really goes right to the heart of what I'm talking about. So Buddha nature arises in our minds. We don't necessarily see it. We can't put our finger on it. We can't pin it down. And honestly, I don't think we ever will be able to. Just have a growing, greater sense of it. It arises in our minds, and we have this so, and that is the substance of things hoped for. That we have faith arising in us, the possibility of having that sense, oh, this seems like a good thing to do, and acting on it, is the evidence of that deeper mind. It's the evidence of things not seen. And that we take that, I see someone's wanting me to talk a little louder, so I'll try that. So we take that thing, that evidence of things not seen, the substance of things hoped for, and we act on it. And by acting on that faith, on that sense that there's something good to do, in a deeper sense, we find the thing that we're looking for. We continuously find it. And we find it as an act of walking this path, or walking our particular spiritual path. So Bodhidharma set out, he came to China. Buddhism, interestingly enough, was in China for 500 years before Bodhidharma showed up on the scene. 500 years. It's an interesting thing to reflect on for our particular time, our particular conditions. 500 years Buddhism was in China. It took another 200 years after Bodhidharma appeared and taught for the Zen tradition to really blossom in China, for it to find a way for the Chinese people to practice it and to really make it a vibrant, live, living thing. Bodhidharma knew the truth. He was a master. He understood what he was doing. He was quite skilled in it. And he was able to pass that on to some people who, in turn, knew and understood. But it took a long time for it to really blossom and become widely available. One aspect of what we're doing that requires or asks us to have faith is that, you know, Buddhism has really only been in the West for 100 years. That's just Buddhism itself, let alone the Zen tradition. So we're in a position where we're doing something quite different, and that's quite hard. There isn't really a vibrant big community that we can do it within. It's quite difficult. So when we undertake this path of training, this path of Buddhism, we should just kind of be a little kind to ourselves and understand, oh, we're kind of in a difficult circumstance here, just a challenging circumstance. And that really requires us to rely on our faith, that there is a good thing to be done here. There is some value to practicing the Dharma. So this morning you recited a line during the scriptures, during the ceremony, Bodhidharma's four practices. Let's see if I can remember it. Acceptance of suffering, sitting unmoved, the seeking of nothing, enlightenment proved. These are four of Bodhidharma's practices. They come from a teaching of his called the Outline of Practice. It's in this book. And this is an encapsulation of four of those practices. Acceptance of suffering. One of the ways, again, that Buddhism is quite different from our Western approach to things in general is that what it's saying is, there is the possibility within our own mind and heart to find peace of mind regardless of external conditions. It's not telling us not to do anything about external conditions, but it is saying there is this possibility. We can find peace of mind regardless of external conditions. We can find peace of heart regardless of external conditions. And the way that we do that is by acceptance of suffering. One of the first steps is, the Buddha taught suffering exists. Suffering is just a thing in the world. I know for myself, there's a part of me that really doesn't like suffering. I really don't like it. I really don't like it in my own mind and heart. But it really bugs me when other people are suffering. I really don't like that. And while in some sense I think this is the arising of the sense of compassion, the wish to relieve other people's suffering, I kind of recognize that there's a part of me which is like to kind of get rid of it, you know, push it away. And over time I've come to see from my own experience that the first step to addressing suffering is to just sit still in it and accept that it is there. And in this way, I can see it more deeply and see what is really going on. A sort of aside, I could spend a whole Dharma talk talking about each of Bodhidharma's practices, so try not to do that. I was told that my little battery pack will give me the ability to speak to you for 2.5 hours. out of compassion for you, I won't try that, and quite honestly, I don't think I could do it myself, so I'll try to keep this brief. Or at least as brief as I can. So there's acceptance of suffering. Now, that verse that I recited takes Bodhidharma's four practices, and it does some interesting things with two of them in terms of how Bodhidharma talks about them and how it says in the verse. So the first... let's see if I can find this. Now that I've taken my bookmark out. According to this translation, the first practice of Bodhidharma is suffering and justice, so acceptance of suffering. The second one, interestingly, he articulates as adapting to conditions. Now, in our little verse, as we recited it this morning, it says sitting unmoved as adapting to conditions. And you might think, on the surface, that seems to be quite the opposite of each other. But in fact, that is again pointing toward our difference of what Buddhism is pointing at and how it practices. That is how we begin to learn how to adapt to conditions, by doing the practice of sitting unmoved. So this morning, I don't normally sit up in front of however many people you are here, you know, with the Buddha behind me and the whole deal here. I'm not usually finding myself in this circumstance, and it makes me quite nervous. My personal self would be really great if everybody just really liked me. But and so whenever the possibility that a whole group of people isn't going to like me, it makes me quite nervous. And you probably have picked up on that. I'm a little nervous this morning. It's frightening, to be honest. So I'm just... Oh, thank you. I'm relieved, and a number of people have told me that, but you know, that part of me just doesn't really believe it. But anyway, I'm not really... I'm not really saying this to elicit that response either. Please believe me. But just to give you an example of what we mean by sitting unmoved. So I noticed this arising in my mind as I'm preparing for the talk this morning. And I noticed this kind of anxiety arising. And my practice is to... I could get up there in my mind and stir it all up and worry about it and run away or do whatever. But instead, I've learned that it's really more helpful for me to just keep coming back to sitting still within it. Just bring my mind back patiently with kindness. And I recognize, oh, there's that thing. Yeah. as my old friend. And it helps me, in some sense, to remind me to return to sitting still, to return to just quietly sitting with it, with kindness and compassion. And in doing that, this is what Bodhidharma's pointing at. Just bringing your mind back, sitting still in whatever conditions arise. And then I can adapt myself as needed. I can do what I need to do and be the person that I need to be for what my life requires of me. So it is out of that effort to sit still within conditions, to bring my mind back to being still, that I begin to be able to do much more than I was able to in the past. In the past, I might be just paralyzed from fear, or as I say, run away, or do something like that, or make more of an idiot of myself than I normally do, something like that. But, again, through the patient effort of training, just sitting still in these conditions, things seem to be a little more manageable. So sitting unmoved is our way of adapting to conditions. The third one, seeking of nothing, that's the phrase that our translator uses and the phrase that we encounter in the scripture that we read this morning, or recited this morning. And it's an interesting point that we are training ourselves to seek for nothing. In one sense, again, using my example of wanting people to like me, that arises out of a sense, a deep sense, that somehow that is missing for me. And that wanting that external thing is a way of addressing that little doubt. The teaching of seeking nothing is the teaching that we have everything that we need right now, just as we are, even with that little question in there. But it doesn't feel like that, something in my mind says. The teaching of seeking nothing is reminding us, no, you have all that you need right here, right now. And when we begin to train ourselves to not look outside for the solution to our suffering, when we begin to train ourselves to trust the meditation practice, the keeping of the precepts. The precepts, by the way, are really a complex encapsulation, a complex articulation of the idea of seeking nothing. They're constantly saying when we're seeking something inappropriately, when we're not. It's a way of teaching us how to seek for nothing. The more we do that, the more we act on faith. I have this kind of overwhelming feeling that there's something out there I need. The more I sit still and let that go, this is the acting of faith. That faith and that little voice in there is saying, but there's some truth in the principle that you have all that you need. There's some truth in that. So the more that we put that into practice, the more we see that that truth exists. The more I sit still in my anxiety this morning, the more I realize, oh, well, first of all, maybe they're kind of okay with me, but maybe I don't really need that. So the seeking of nothing, again, very helpful practice. And then the fourth practice is, again, articulated a little differently than our translator here puts it. In our verse this morning, it's enlightenment proved. And the way that our translator here translates it as is practicing the Dharma. Now, enlightenment proved, I think, is quite a useful way of looking at that, practicing the Dharma. Because it implies, okay, we're going to prove that enlightenment exists by putting the teaching into practice. Okay, there's that level of it. But it's also telling us, it's also saying to us, again, like seeking nothing, we have all that we need. Enlightenment exists. There is something else. There is something beyond our present experience. The enlightenment of the Buddha exists. It is a real thing. We can't find that thing in the ways that we have encountered before. We can't find that thing in conventional methodology. We can't find that thing through science. We can't find that thing through rational explanation. It's not a philosophy, this thing. It's not magic. It emerges from the activity of faith. It emerges from putting the Dharma into practice. And in one sense, you could think that I'm saying, you know, what we're doing is the only way to find the truth, and that's not exactly it. I'm talking about the Dharma, the practice of spiritual life in itself, the truth of that practice. And that truth of practice can emerge in different ways. Again, I start off by saying, oh, we're doing something really different than Christianity. But one of the great kind of examples of bodhisattva practice in my life is my uncle, who is a good Lutheran man living in farm country in eastern Washington. He's kind of an amazing bodhisattva. He was a fourth, fifth, and sixth grade school teacher. And the way that he told me once that he had a little girl in his class, and he was looking at her, and he just realized, Jesus is looking out of her face at me, and I have to treat this person with utmost respect. And you could see by the way that he talked about his classes and the way that he dealt with people that this is how he really lived his life. He treated each person as if they were a Buddha. And this is what we can do as well. Good Christian man. And he trained himself to be that way. My mom kind of shake her head at him at when we were talking about him. Yeah, when he was a young man, he was really obnoxious. Just sort of, you know. But he converted himself. He trained himself to live in this deeper way. So I'm not talking about any kind of exclusive or dogmatic approach, but I'm saying what we're looking for, that thing that we're looking for, enlightenment proved, emerges from the training of the mind, the practice of the Dharma, the detailed application of meditation and the precepts to our own mind. And each one of us has that potential to find that thing in our daily life. In our tradition, there's an interesting thing that happens. We sort of have this kind of holographic way of approaching the Dharma. It's just one way. It just happens to be our way. It's a sort of holographic way of approaching the Dharma. When you come here for an introduction, when you come and get meditation instruction, you're actually given the whole of our tradition. You don't realize it, but you're given the whole of our tradition. You're taught how to meditate. You're taught that the precepts exist. And you're given the scripture of great wisdom. It's all right there. That's the whole of our tradition. It's holographic. We don't realize that until we've kind of gone through the process of learning all the different aspects and learning how to put it into practice and studying our minds. But there it is, right there. We keep the precepts. We sit still in meditation. We study the scripture of great wisdom. We put it into practice. So all of you are kind of fully equipped. Now, one of the precepts is taking refuge in the Sangha, practicing with a group. We have to put those things into practice. I ran into a man in a service station in Ventura, California. I'm wearing my robes. I'm getting gas. I think I'm coming home from some Dharma talk or something like that. And he's like, oh, you're a monk. I just came from an empowerment ceremony at such and such Tibetan center. And, you know, it was cool and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, oh, that's interesting. Oh, so now you're in, forgive me. You could see that he thought he had gotten something kind of great and he had been affirmed in some way in his practice. I'm thinking to myself, well, doesn't it mean, so now you're empowered to do that practice. And empowerment doesn't mean that you have done that practice and now are an expert in it. It means that now you can do that practice. It's useful to kind of keep in mind that we do need to do the practice. We do need to act on faith. We do need to follow up on bodhicitta as it arises in our heart. Or as Dogen puts it, the mind that seeks the way. The more we do that, the more deeply we understand what the Buddha was talking about. Ajahn Chah, famous Theravadan meditation teacher in Thailand, says something like, a little bit of letting go, little bit of peace. Medium letting go, medium peace. Complete letting go, complete peace. And this is not another standard from which to judge ourselves or beat ourselves up. We have to approach this from a Buddhist perspective and appreciate that a little bit of letting go is actually a pretty good thing if we can manage that. And in one sense, like I'm giving you the example of my own kind of anxiety this morning, each one of those little steps along the way, I'm looking at my mind and thinking, oh, a little bit of letting go here. And the next, little bit of letting go. That's how our life of practice goes. It's one little step of letting go, followed by one little step of letting go. So, again, no need to kind of hold ourselves to an unattainable standard. Our ancestor line, again, is a human list of human beings who did this thing. And they did this thing through one little step at a time. They lived out their lives, according to the Buddha Dharma, one little step at a time. And we can do that as well. So, thank you all very much.